You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, People Rise Up. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland. And I need to let you know that this program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media, and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. So, welcome. My name is Andrew Geller, and we are going to be finishing off a program I started a couple of months ago almost, a rarity here on the program, but the topic at hand and the timing of everything just didn't allow us to fit the whole thing into one program. And I'm referencing the April 6th Pledge Drive special, which featured Jeffrey Stone, who is a law professor at the University of Chicago, but possibly more importantly, the author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, From the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. And he joins us once again so we can finish talking about this extraordinarily detailed book. So welcome back to our airwaves, Jeffrey.
Delighted to be here.
Now, for folks who were listening to that show, you'll recall that we finished talking about we kind of began talking about World War I, and that's where the show ended. So that's where we're going to pick up again. The first chunk of the show is available at the People Rise Up website. If you scroll down to April 6th, there's an MP3 link, so you can see that and listen to that as well. So let's do a teeny bit of overlap from where I think we actually ended off talking about World War I, and that was with the adoption of the second Sedition Act. The first was 1798, and then came the Sedition Act of 1918. And you subtitled that section, When Did It Become War on the American People?
Correct. In World War I, the Wilson administration was determined to stifle any criticism of the war or the draft. And it first enacted in 1917 legislation under the name of the Espionage Act of 1917. And when the administration found that that did not completely do the job, it then went back in 1918 and got Congress to enact the Sedition Act of 1918, which essentially made it a criminal offense for any person to criticize the president, the war, the draft, the flag, the Constitution, the military, or the uniform of the military of the United States. and it was a particularly draconian measure. It authorized prison sentences of up to 20 years in jail for doing nothing more than literally criticizing the government in its decision to enter into and to fight the First World War.
Now, I think it's important to note that the Espionage Act of 1917, the Sedition Act of 1918, were the first legislative efforts since the 1798 Sedition Act against disloyal expression. The Civil War, as folks may recall from the previous show, there wasn't an effort legislatively along those lines, although President Lincoln did do some things executively that, you know, somewhat had the same effect. So it's really significant, I think, that Congress actually acted here. Let's see, where do I have this? Ah, okay, on page 183 you write, "The dominant mood of the public was repressive to a degree that is hard for contemporary Americans to imagine." And we're going to come back to that idea when we get to talking about the present day with the Patriot Act. But what was it that, you know, what was the public sentiment? Where did the move come from to have Congress act? Was it being led by the Wilson executive branch?
Well, in 1918, the mood of the country had, in fact, become extremely intolerant. And a number of factors led to that state of affairs. First, at the time that we entered the war, there was, in fact, great ambivalence within the United States about whether this was a war the United States should be involved in at all. And the Wilson administration initiated a very aggressive propaganda campaign under the auspices of a organization created by Wilson called the Committee on Public Information, which was essentially a propaganda arm of the executive branch of the federal government. And it was designed for the purpose of whipping up a hatred of anything associated with Germany, including German Americans, and a hatred and suspicion of anyone who might not fully support the war. And this was extremely effective, and the Committee on Public Information used leaflets and editorials and speakers and movies, all of which were intended to whip up this kind of frenzy of hysteria about the threat to the United States, the danger to the United States if we did not win the war. And it was, over the course of a year, quite effective. Second, of course, there were substantial casualties in World War I, and as often is the case, as casualties grow in a wartime environment, many people become increasingly intolerant of criticism of a war. Their view is that we shall not have allowed those boys in World War I to die in vain. And the people who have lost loved ones, the people who have loved ones over their fighting, do not want to hear that they're fighting for an unjust or a unnecessary cause. And so that leads to a deepening of the sense of intolerance. So by the time we got to 1918, there was an increasing sense of unwillingness of the American people to hear anyone who could be cast as a traitor because they questioned the wisdom of the war or of the draft. The particular impetus for the 1918 legislation, interestingly, was that a few federal judges had courageously interpreted either the 1917 statute or the First Amendment to the Constitution so as to limit the power of the federal government to punish those individuals who criticized the war to only those who at least were doing so in circumstances in which there was likely to be a serious harm, or other judges took the view that you could only punish people if they expressly advocated that other people should violate the law. And the administration was very upset with those judges and with those decisions, even though there were only a handful of them among hundreds, indeed thousands, of prosecutions. And so partly they wanted to simply eliminate any ambiguity that judges could take advantage of in order to protect the dissent, the right to dissent. And second, interestingly, an important theme in the debates over the 1918 Act were that in some communities in the United States, citizens became so outraged at dissenters that they would hang them or beat them or tar and feather them. And instead of doing what we would, I think, expect the government to do today, which is to say it's the responsibility of the government to protect dissenters against those other private citizens who would harass, beat, or murder them, instead the government's argument was that we have to stop those speakers because they are enraging the public and leading the public into taking these terrible steps, and to prevent those terrible steps, we have to simply silence the speakers. And that's a very interesting mindset that I think we would today find to be quite foreign to the way we think about these sorts of issues. But at that time, it was a much more congenial way of thinking, that it's not so much that you restrain the mob, it's that you restrain the people who set off the mob. And so that was one of the critical arguments that was made in defense of the Sedition Act. We have to prevent the dissenters in order to protect them from intolerant private citizens.
I think it's important to note that the Committee on Public Information you referenced is also known as the Creel Commission, and it was sort of the launch of the what turned into the modern-day public relations industry, as put forth by Edward Bernays back at the time. And just to further elaborate on your pointing out that folks wanted to limit speech and that folks who spoke out in dissenting ways at the time of World War One, you know, those people were the problem. Senator Kenneth McKellar of Tennessee said, quote, "A man who has no more sense than to think that some other government is greater or better than the American government, or that some other constitution is greater or better than the American constitution, ought not to be in this country." And so that's the, I don't know if that was the original instance or that era was the original point at which there was the whole love it or leave it. Because I mean, that's
well,
basically
it actually
what
goes
that
back
is.
Even to 1798, the concept of love it or leave it, and okay. Probably far beyond that. But that statement certainly captures the essence of that sentiment perfectly. And it's also typical of the kind of intolerance that became very prevalent during World War One. The notion that if you are not with us, you are against us, and if you're not with us, you're either going to go to jail or you should get the hell out of the country.
Now, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court didn't have much in the way of experience interpreting the First Amendment, and specifically the free speech provisions of the First Amendment, by this time, up to 1918, 1919. And it was in 1919 that the court handed down what you say was its first significant decision interpreting the First Amendment, and that's Schenck v. U.S., where the phrase clear and present danger first made its appearance in our legal lexicon. Can you tell us a little bit about Schenck v. U.S.?
Sure. It's surprising to most people to realize that the Supreme Court did not actually have occasion to apply or interpret the First Amendment to the Constitution in any meaningful context until 1919, until 125 years, more than 125 years after the First Amendment was added to the Constitution. So Schenck was the first case that directly required the court to give meaning to the phrase, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. And Schenck was a socialist who had participated in the distribution of leaflets opposing the draft and the United States' entry into World War One, essentially claiming that this was not a war to make the world safe for democracy. It was essentially a war designed to make the world safe for munitions manufacturers and for capitalists, and that the draft was a little better than legalized slavery and violated the Constitution. For distributing this leaflet, Schenck was arrested and prosecuted for violating the 1917 Act on the theory that he had attempted to obstruct the draft. And when the case came to the Supreme Court, the court was unanimous in upholding Schenck's conviction, saying that, in fact, this conviction did not violate his rights under the First Amendment. Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the opinion for the majority, for the unanimous court, And in this opinion, Holmes basically made clear that there are things that one might be able to say in peacetime that may not be permissible in wartime. And it was in this opinion that he made two really very famous phrases for the first time. First, in order to demonstrate that the phrase "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech" could not literally mean what it says, what it appears to say, could not be absolute, he offered his famous example of the false cry of fire in a crowded theater. And he essentially said that obviously the First Amendment can't mean that government can never restrict speech, because it would be ludicrous to suggest that a person has a right to falsely cry fire in a crowded theater and cause people to be injured in the dash to the exits. And that was a perfectly apt illustration of the fact that the First Amendment cannot be absolute in the literal sense. And what that made clear is that the phrase, the freedom of speech, requires interpretation. What it is that Congress cannot abridge is not necessarily the right to say anything at any time in any manner one pleases, but it has to be given substance, and only by interpreting the words of the freedom of speech can one then decide what it is that the Congress may not abridge. So Holmes then turned to that question, and essentially there he says, well, the test should be whether the speech creates a clear and present danger of harm that Congress has a right to prevent. And he extrapolated from the false cry of fire in a crowded theater his standard. In other words, he used that hypothetical not only to demonstrate that the First Amendment is not literally absolute, but also to say, well, let's see, why is the false cry of fire in a crowded theater obviously punishable? The answer, he said, is because it creates a clear and present danger of harm. And that, therefore, is the meaning of the First Amendment, of the phrase, the freedom of speech. Congress may punish a person for creating a clear and present danger of harm. And then the question that one would ask is, okay, well, was there a clear and present danger of harm in the circumstances of Schenck? And one might argue that in the fire in a crowded theater context, what creates the idea of a clear and present danger is that the very yelling of the word fire creates an instinctive and immediate reaction by the audience that causes the harm, the trampling on the way to the exit. And if that's what clear and present danger means, then obviously that's very different from what's going on in Schenck, who's simply handing out leaflets that people can read, reflect upon, and decide for themselves over any period of time whether they will or will not do whatever it is that they might do to oppose the war or the draft. So one might have expected Holmes, after going this far, to say, okay, the test is fire in a crowded, the test is clear and present danger, the paradigm of clear and present danger is fire in a crowded theater, and obviously Schenck's handing out the leaflets is not analogous to fire in a crowded theater, because the harm is neither as clear or as present, as imminent, as it is in the theater example. But instead, Holmes and the unanimous court says that Schenck can be convicted. Essentially, it takes the phrase clear and present danger, which it invents in that opinion, and then it construes it to really have very little meaning of the sort we would today associate with it. Today, if someone said clear and present danger, we would quite naturally think it means something like what happens when someone yells fire in a crowded theater. But that's not what Holmes meant by it, because he affirmed Schenck's conviction, and therefore what he meant by it is simply that there is a logical connection between the speech and the harm, even if it's fairly remote from the speech to the harm itself, and even though the individual who's going to eventually perhaps act unlawfully is making an independent decision to do that, not in any way reflexively or automatically as a result of the speech. So the very famous opinion in Schenck, which gives rise to the fire in a crowded theater and the clear and present danger phrases, in fact, at the time, was an extremely repressive opinion, interpreting the First Amendment ultimately very narrowly and allowing the conviction of Schenck and of a host of other people like Schenck who were prosecuted under the World War I legislation.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guest this morning is Jeffrey Stone, University of Chicago law professor and author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. Now, the issue of, or the sort of revelation or construct of the clear and present danger argument would play a very significant role about three decades later in legal proceedings against Communist Party members, and we'll get to that later. The whole issue of express advocacy, or are you just talking and not encouraging anyone to actually act? And it was the ruling in Schenck v. U.S. that noted a shift in how the Supreme Court dealt with First Amendment cases. And let's kind of jump forward now, unless there's anything you want to still mention regarding the World War I era.
Well, yeah, I do think it's important to mention the Abrams decision, which came down a few months after Schenck, because it really is the first pivotal shift within the court. And to leave Justice Holmes where I just did would be a great disservice to him, because when the decision in Schenck comes down, the people who are supporting the suppression of speech in wartime are delighted. The civil libertarians are horrified. 6 months later, the Supreme Court hands down its decision in the Abrams case. Basically a very similar case. This is a bunch of Jewish Russian emigres who throw leaflets off a rooftop in the Lower East Side of New York, mm-hmm. protesting various acts of the United States in World War I, and they are arrested and prosecuted and convicted under the Sedition Act of 1918, and they're sentenced to prison terms of 15 to 20 years in jail for doing that. And the case comes to the Supreme Court, and everyone would have expected, given the decision in Schenck 6 months earlier, that the court would regard this as an easy case and would again uphold the convictions. In fact, seven of the nine justices did just that, and they essentially said this case is no different than Schenck, and we therefore say that these people can go to prison. But what was startling is that suddenly Justice Holmes, joined by Justice Brandeis, writes a blistering and eloquent dissenting opinion in which he essentially says that to convict these individuals for their expression is no more legitimate than to convict an individual for reading the U.S. Constitution in public. And he there takes the words clear and present danger and for the first time construes them the way we would today imagine those words would mean. And he says these individuals did not, in fact, create a clear and present danger of any grave harm to the government, and that only an emergency, he says, would justify suppression of speech. And it's that opinion in Abrams, a wonderfully eloquent opinion, in which Holmes gives birth to the whole tradition of judicial protection of the First Amendment that we've now in our society come to expect, but which owes a great debt of gratitude to Holmes and Brandeis for elaborating this view, beginning with the Abrams case in the fall of 1919, taking a totally different position from what Holmes had taken only a few months earlier in the spring of 1919.
Now, following World War I, there was a period of intense red baiting, I suppose the first serious sustained instance of this here in the U.S. The Russian Revolution happened during the end of World War I. Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer is in charge, and the Palmer raids happened not long after World War I ended. And in a twist that was to, at the time, no one could really foresee that this would have such a profound impact on law enforcement here in the United States, but a young man enters the Justice Department, and he was named J. Edgar Hoover, and he actually ended up sticking around for close to 60 years, sort of not entirely creating the FBI, but he certainly worked what he could to create an entity that he eventually would run for a very long time. And so the 20s, there's you know, there's anti-communist sentiment running real strong here in the U.S., and the Nazis rise to power, or fascists rise to power in both Italy, Japan, Germany, and eventually Spain. And there's some spillover in terms of the fascist uprisings in Europe and Asia. And, you know, there was a, I suppose, you know, never real strong, but, you know, significant Nazi movement here in the United States. And this came to play a role in legal areas. The let's see, I'm trying to flip here to find these right pages. Well, there was Martin Dees and the whole Dees Committee. And then, let me see here. I'm losing my context for the Smith Act. When did the Smith Act come into being?
1940.
Okay, so it's a little bit later.
Right.
So let's back up a little bit then and deal with the issue of prosecutions of the Nazis here in the U.S., most specifically the guy kind of erroneously referred to as the American Hitler, William Dudley Pelley.
Right. Well, Pelley was a very interesting character. After the Red Scare and after World War One, Americans in the press, in higher education, in the media generally, in politics, sort of caught their breath and said, you know, what have we wrought? They looked back on the era of the First World War and the Red Scare and said, we went way overboard, and we acted terribly repressively. And so they repealed the Sedition Act of 1918. Those people who had not yet been deported during World War One and were still in prison were gradually released, and eventually they were their civil and political rights were restored. And there was a sense of having learned from the excesses of that era. And then as we moved into the 1930s and the rise of fascism in Europe, interestingly, it was primarily the liberal establishment that began calling for restrictions on the freedom of speech of fascists in the United States because of their concerns that Americans would be susceptible to the appeal of fascism in the same way that the conservative elements in the United States had been concerned both before and after this era that individuals would be susceptible to the appeal of communism. And there were a number of very prominent fascist figures during this period, Father Coughlin being one, obviously, and Pelley was really, I think, one of the most interesting of them. Pelley was an individual who grew up poor, was, in fact, very talented, and wound up being a writer, and wrote many short stories and articles for leading magazines, became quite prominent as a young man, as a short story writer and feature writer, moved to Hollywood, became a very prominent screenwriter, was listed in Who's Who in the United States, wrote movie scripts for people like Tom Mix and others. And then after several years in Hollywood, he basically had a nervous breakdown and went into isolation in the Sierra Madre, and then had a out-of-body experience, which he then wrote about, in which he essentially said that he had gone to whatever, wherever it is that people go when they die, he had gone there, and he had spent 7 minutes in eternity, and this was widely read and fascinating reading, because he was a wonderful writer, and it basically was about the fact that he had gone into this place, and he'd come back saying he has a mission to lead. And he didn't know where that mission would take him, but on the day that Adolf Hitler was named Chancellor of Germany, he founded the Silver Shirts in the United States. And the Silver Shirts were essentially a Nazi-style organization in the United States, much more militant in many ways than the German-American Bund. And he produced a lot of pamphlets and newspapers and books. He went around the country giving speeches and organizing, and eventually the organization had as many as 15,000 members, and his publications had an audience of as many as 50,000 readers. And as we approached World War II, he was increasingly regarded as a person who was of considerable concern to the United States government. As Pearl Harbor approached, President Roosevelt became increasingly annoyed with Pelley, who was extremely critical of Roosevelt, believed that the New Deal was a fiasco, that Roosevelt had led the nation into bankruptcy. He constantly referred to Roosevelt as if he were Jewish, said that Roosevelt had been led by a conspiracy of Zionists and was trying to get the United States into the war. And finally, after Pearl Harbor, Pelley basically had to disband the Silver Shirts because it was no longer safe or sensible for people to march around in Nazi-style uniforms after we entered the war against Germany. But Pelley himself continued to produce his publications, and they continued to be sharply critical of Roosevelt, maintained that the United States was... at Pearl Harbor that we'd suffered a much more devastating injury to our naval forces, and Roosevelt had admitted and claimed that Roosevelt had lied to the American people, claimed that Roosevelt had manipulated the situation in Japan in order to bait Japan into attacking us, and Roosevelt kept pushing Attorney General Francis Biddle to prosecute Pelley. And Biddle kept resisting. Biddle kept saying, no, this is free speech. We should not be prosecuting him. And Roosevelt stayed on him week after week after week. And finally, Biddle relented, and Pelley was prosecuted by the federal government on the theory that he had made false statements of fact, and that these various statements that I've already identified, the United States is bankrupt, that there's division within the United States about supporting the war, that Roosevelt had engineered the situation in the Pacific so as to essentially manipulate Japan into attacking the United States, he was prosecuted on the theory that those were false statements of fact that violated the Espionage Act of 1917, and the government, in order to prove this, would do things like call a banker as a witness to testify that the United States wasn't bankrupt, or to call a traveling salesman to testify that he had never heard anybody criticize the war, and therefore there was not division within the United States. And the jury convicted Pelley, and he was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Pelley is a wonderful example of the dangers of allowing the government to label as false statements which, in fact, are statements of opinion, partly because they were, in fact, statements that we would truly understand as opinions, not as the light is red, the light is green in a traffic accident case. Moreover, what's interesting is as historians have come to understand the actual situation, both leading up to World War II and at Pearl Harbor, it's, in fact, quite sensible to conclude that Pelley's accusations were accurate,
right.
That Roosevelt had lied to the American people about the extent of the harm to the fleet in Pearl Harbor, and that, in fact, Roosevelt had manipulated Japan by using an oil embargo in order to force them into attacking the United States. And so what's interesting about the Pelley situation is that this is a loathsome person. I mean, this was a truly loathsome individual. He was speaking in ways that would have been useful for the American public to hear and useful to require the American government to answer. And instead, what they did was prosecute him and lock him away for 15 years.
I think it's also interesting to note that in 1935, Pelley announced he was running for president on the Christian Party ticket, and as a campaign slogan, used "For Christ and Constitution." And I think it's really fascinating that that was used by, he himself referred to himself as the American Hitler, which I thought was someone else applying that to him. But, 70 years ago, we had fascists promoting the idea of Christ and Constitution. And you look at the political situation at the federal level here today in the Bush administration, and it's just a little bizarre and creepy, the parallel. Anyway, so why don't we get into, because we're halfway past here, and we're still just inching up on World War II. So we're going to skip important stuff. And for folks who are interested in this, pick yourself up a copy of the book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. Jeffrey Stone, the author, is my guest this morning. So the big, I suppose the big case regarding World War II and, it wasn't exactly free speech, but the internment of the Japanese.
Right. In World War II, there were some speech issues, but for the most part, the United States was united since we had been attacked in World War II, unlike World War I. And except for a few fascists like Pelley, there was very little dissent during the Second World War, and therefore there was no need for the government to do the kinds of things that it had done in the First World War. So the major civil liberties issue in World War II was, of course, as you say, the internment of almost 120,000 persons of Japanese descent. dissent. And this is one of the great tragedies of American history, and it's a great example of how a wartime environment can warp the thinking of well-meaning, thoughtful individuals for a variety of different motives to cause them to do things that are extraordinarily excessive and unjust. So after Pearl Harbor, there was no demand on the West Coast, or in Hawaii for that matter, for the internment of individuals of Japanese descent. The FBI had gone around the country and arrested those individuals who were German, Italian, or Japanese citizens who were in the United States, who it believed would be a potential danger to the nation, and that amounted to about a dozen or so thousand people, and they were given hearings, and gradually they were released or held, depending upon findings as to whether they did pose a real danger to the nation. And in the month or so after Pearl Harbor, that was basically the way the matter was handled. But during this period of a month or 6 weeks after Pearl Harbor, there were rumors about Japanese espionage and sabotage, all of which were not only proved later to be untrue, but even at the time were acknowledged to be untrue after investigation. But nonetheless, rumors have the quality of rumors, and they spread, and they developed a sense of distrust. Moreover, the American had difficulty looking at individuals who were of Japanese descent and wondering whether they were American citizens or not American citizens, whether they were citizens of Japan, whether they were loyal or disloyal, trustworthy or not trustworthy. And there were also economic pressures that came to bear on the West Coast about seeing this as an opportunity to move the Japanese out of the economic competition that existed on the West Coast. So there were long-standing issues of racism, there were issues of economic opportunism, and there were genuine issues of hysteria that led to a growing movement to get the individuals who were of Japanese descent, including American citizens, out of the West Coast. Initially, the military on the West Coast took the view that this was unnecessary, but as the political demand grew, the military eventually acquiesced and recommended to President Roosevelt that there should be the removal and ultimately internment of all of these individuals of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of whom, I want to emphasize, were American citizens, not Japanese citizens, but American citizens. And Roosevelt, when he received the recommendation to do this, found himself faced with strong opposition from Attorney General Francis Biddle, the same Attorney General who had also opposed the prosecution of Pelley. It was opposed by J. Edgar Hoover, interestingly, who basically said, look, we've already rounded up all the people we believe to be in any way a threat to the United States national security. This is just a matter of racism, Hoover said. The Secretary of War, Stimson, regarded it as a tragic step. Nonetheless, Roosevelt decided to sign the executive order and to direct the internment of all of these individuals who were ordered, in effect, to report to bus terminals and train stations with only whatever they could carry on their backs, leaving everything else behind. And they were then sent to essentially concentration camps where they stayed for the next better part of the next 3 years. And when one asked why did Franklin Roosevelt do this, the best answer I've been able to find is that Roosevelt, 1942 was an election year. There was strong sentiment in California, Washington, Arizona, and Oregon at this point to get rid of these individuals. And rather than run the risk of alienating the electorate in those four states, Roosevelt essentially acquiesced, even over the advice of his Attorney General, of the Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and of the Secretary of War, and largely out of political expediency, ordered these individuals to be interned. And one of the truly great tragedies in American history.
Now, long story short, obviously the internment was challenged. Key among them was a challenge led by a man named Fred Korematsu, who, in fact, you helped represent in the U.S. Supreme Court, I imagine much more recently as opposed to way long ago.
Yes, I represented Mr. Korematsu as a friend of the court in the Guantanamo Bay cases last spring, in which the question was whether the detention of individuals in Guantanamo Bay or also Hamdi and Padilla was a violation of the federal constitution. And Korematsu's standing was really historical in terms of his ability to present an argument to the court that here was a direct reminder of our own history. Korematsu was ordered during World War II to be interned. He essentially declined to do that. He was picked up, arrested, and prosecuted for refusing to participate in the internment. He maintained that this internment order violated the United States Constitution. The case came to the U.S. Supreme Court, which in 1944, in a divided set of decisions, held that the U.S. government did have the authority to intern all of these individuals, including Mr. Korematsu, who was an American citizen, and basically said, this is not about racism, this is about military security, and we cannot second-guess the military in these circumstances. There were very strong dissents in the case from justices like Frank Murphy and Robert Jackson, who essentially said that this was an unwarranted abuse of federal power. But the majority acquiesced in the decision. And that's a decision by the Supreme Court that's never been cited with approval for the result, and obviously is a great embarrassment to the Supreme Court, like Schenck, which we talked about earlier. And so Korematsu wanted to be represented before the Supreme Court in the Guantanamo Bay cases as a reminder to the court of what happens when it does not stand true to its responsibility independently to protect constitutional liberties, and when it gives undue deference to the claims of the executive about deference. And I believe that it was in part with an eye towards remembering what had happened in Korematsu that the justices rebuffed all of the Bush administration claims about its authorities with respect to detentions in those cases last spring.
And in his dissenting opinion in the Korematsu case back in the 40s, Justice Frank Murphy wrote sort of a modification of the clear and present danger concept in the Schenck decision, and that, you know, public danger had to be, quote, immediate, imminent, and impending, which is similar to clear and present. You know, to have the internments actually be declared legal, and he just said, you know, it wasn't immediate, imminent, or impending. Now, again, I hate to jump around like this and skip over all kinds of important stuff, but if we don't, we're going to have to leave some stuff out. Would you prefer to leave out Vietnam era, or would you prefer to leave out prosecutions of the Communist Party of the USA post-World War II?
Why don't we do those two very quickly? I could do them in like 2 minutes, but it's probably worth doing them.
Okay.
After World War II ended, there was a sense that the United States was going to be at peace. And almost immediately, we fell into the Cold War, and there were grave concerns about Soviet espionage and sabotage within the United States. Those concerns were real and legitimate, but they were also seen as an opportunity for politicians to use the red card as a way of gaining political clout. And essentially, the argument was that the Democrats who'd been in office for 16 years had allowed individuals to insinuate themselves into higher education, into the media, into the government, into labor unions, who at one time or another in their history had been affiliated with organizations that had connections to the Communist Party, and therefore they might be spies and they pose a danger to the country, and we have to ferret them out and prosecute them, and it's the Democrats' fault that these people are there. They haven't protected the national security. And so people like Joseph McCarthy and Richard Nixon grabbed hold of that argument and used it to manipulate fear among the American people, distrust of one another, leading to the prosecution of the leaders of the Communist Party of the United States, and to blacklisting and to investigations and all of the elements that we've now come to see as what we now understand to be McCarthyism. And again, as in each of these episodes, as we know, by the time we get to around 1960, people look on what they've been doing and realize again with horror, as they did after World War I and again after World War II, that we've allowed ourselves to fall victim to a kind of hysteria and a kind of manipulation that has caused us to wildly overreact to the dangers presented in the situation. And when we today think back on that era, we think back on it for the most part with a sense of shame. And the problem is, as it has been in all these episodes, is how do we avoid repeating those same mistakes each time we find ourselves in a wartime environment? In Vietnam, we really had reached, I think, a significant watershed. By the time we get to Vietnam, partly because of judicial decisions interpreting the First Amendment, and partly because of changes in our culture, we, for the first time in our history, had reached the point where we would not prosecute a political figure for opposing the war or the draft. That is, the idea of prosecuting Eugene McCarthy in 1968 would have seemed unthinkable at that time, just as the idea of prosecuting Howard Dean in 2004 would seem unthinkable today. And yet it's important to recognize that throughout American history, in 1798, in the Civil War, in World War I, with the prosecution of Eugene Debs, the national leader of the Socialist Party, that we had a long history of, in fact, prosecuting people exactly like Eugene McCarthy and Howard Dean. And yet by 1968, we had really come sufficient distance, so the idea of prosecuting such people was really no longer on the table. And the problem then facing the Johnson and Nixon administrations is, if you can't prosecute the people who criticize the government, then how can you control them? How can you limit dissent? How can you limit the difficulties that the government faces when you have people criticizing its policies if you can't simply threaten them with jail? And so what the government did in that era was to develop what we have come now to understand as COINTELPRO, which stands for Counterintelligence Program. And this was developed initially in the late 50s by the FBI, and it came into its full force in the 1960s and early 70s under Johnson and particularly under Nixon. And the basic idea of COINTELPRO was to disrupt and expose and to neutralize those individuals who were members of organizations or movements that opposed the policies of the current, whichever current administration it was. It included civil rights activists, and it certainly included, during the Vietnam War, anti-war activists. So basically the way COINTELPRO worked is that FBI would infiltrate or use informers to infiltrate a wide range of organizations that were in some way or another opposing Johnson or Nixon administration policies. And once infiltrated into the organizations, these individuals would do a variety of things. First, they would report, of course, on the names of all of the individuals who had contributed either financially or time or effort to those organizations and to those movements. Beyond that, they would literally attempt to disrupt the activities by doing such things as, for example, sending out notices of meetings that were fraudulent. So people would show up and there was no meeting, and then they'd get annoyed and they'd be disenchanted with the organization. Or they would send letters to spouses telling them anonymously that their husband or wife was having an affair. Or they would send letters to members of the group saying that one member of the group was embezzling funds, or even, interestingly, accusing a member of the group of being an FBI informant. So the real FBI informant would actually foster dissension within the anti-war group by essentially spreading a rumor that a different member of the group, who was not in fact an FBI agent, was one. And so by doing this, the idea was to simply disrupt all of the anti-war movement. And the other part of it was, you took the names that were being reported, and by 1974, when this all first became public, it turned out that more than 500,000 Americans had files in the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Agency, and an Army intelligence as a result, largely, of the activities of COINTELPRO. And those files were not just sitting there. They were being used for a purpose. So individuals had their tax returns audited. Individuals had their landlords receive anonymous letters telling them that they were commies. They had local police alerted to the fact that these individuals were dangerous and that they should harass them. So the problem was, instead of being able to criminally prosecute, the government resorted instead to this much more indirect tactic of, as COINTELPRO documents themselves put it, to expose, disrupt, and neutralize critics of the government. And when all of this came to light, Congress held hearings on it, and Attorney General Edward Levy adopted what became known as the Levy Guidelines in 1976, which prohibited the FBI from engaging in any surveillance or infiltration of any organization engaged in protected First Amendment activities in the absence of clear evidence of criminal conduct. And those guidelines stayed in effect for 25 years and were repealed a few years ago by Attorney General John Ashcroft, which reauthorizes the FBI to engage in the same kinds of activities that had been disclosed in 1974 and condemned by Attorney General Levy.
I think it's also important to note that the Vietnam era and the COINTELPRO era, although run the COINTELPRO was run by the FBI, the CIA for the first time was used domestically, and then President Johnson ordered that, fully aware of the illegality of utilizing the CIA on U.S. soil. You know, a trend that, you know, has possibly continued, but what has definitely continued are the practices of COINTELPRO under other names and to varying degrees. As you note, the Attorney General guidelines were repealed in, well, maybe not 2001, but 2002 for sure.
Correct, 2002.
Were they absolutely repealed?
Yes.
Okay, so they're it's as if they never existed.
Correct.
So we're back to like the early 70s in terms of what the FBI can do.
Correct.
Patriot Act, USA Patriot Act, is probably the most widely known piece of post-September 11 related legislation. And, you know, I haven't read all however many hundreds of pages, and I keep up on court decisions related to it as best I can. But as far as I'm aware, there's nothing in there that specifically limits First Amendment rights. There's sort of a chilling effect as a result of some of its provisions, like the government can see what books you're reading at the library or purchasing, etc. Is that correct, that there's no specific limitation on First Amendment rights in there, as far as you're aware?
First, I mean, it depends what you mean by limitation on First Amendment rights. There's nothing that says it shall be unlawful to criticize the government or the war, in so many words. So absolutely, there's nothing like a Sedition Act that's been put in place, not remotely like that. The issues about the First Amendment that arise here have to do with at least two different types of problems. One is the prohibition on activity that can be seen as providing support for organizations that engage in terrorist activities. That may seem like an obviously sensible thing for the government to prohibit, but as the court eventually came to recognize during the Cold War period, many individuals support organizations for many different reasons, and they often do it without even a full awareness of the various activities that an organization engages in. And so what the Supreme Court eventually came to in the 1960s was that an individual could not be punished for being a member of an organization that advocates the violent overthrow of government if the individual does not specifically intend to further the unlawful goals of the organization and, in fact, actively pursue those unlawful goals. And what the Patriot Act does and other federal legislation does is to prohibit individuals to provide any material support to any organization that may engage in terrorist activity, which is kind of the analog for advocating a violent overthrow of government. And the problem that's arisen and that many courts, lower courts, have been wrestling with is to what extent the First Amendment must give individuals the freedom to support organizations that maybe unbeknownst to them or even if known to them, also do lawful things as well as bad things. And the precedents from the Cold War era would suggest that there are some provisions of the Patriot Act in that regard that pose very serious First Amendment questions. And the other element of the Act that poses serious questions, as you note, are those that authorize the government to engage in various kinds of surveillance of emails, of libraries, and of internet activities that empower the government to do things quite similar to what was going on in COINTELPRO. And the key question is whether the government's surveillance of what we do in and of itself can be said to violate the First Amendment, if the government is not directly doing anything to punish you for the actions. So the simplest example of that is suppose that there's a public demonstration, and we know that if you march in a public demonstration, people will see you there, and private newspapers, for example, can take photographs, and they may publish the photographs to show you who's there, and you have no right to prevent yourself from being seen. But suppose, in addition to that, the government sends government photographers there for the purpose of taking photographs, taking names, and creating files on everyone who participates in that demonstration. Well, the concern there is that the very fact of the government engaging in that surveillance will intimidate people in terms of their willingness to assert and exercise their First Amendment rights because they don't know what will happen with that information. And this is a very important point to understand about the nature of free speech. For me to march in a demonstration, or for me to sign a petition, or for me to take a particular book out of a library, or for me to attend a lecture, is not going to change American policy one whit. And I know that. And if I know that if I march in a demonstration or sign a petition, there is even a very small possibility that the federal government is going to wind up creating a file on me, which might later be used to see me as someone who is disloyal and, unbeknownst to me, wind up costing me the opportunity at a job with the government or in a defense plant or with a government contractor, because that file exists and gets circulated behind the scenes, that I may say, you know what, I think I won't sign that petition. I think I won't march in that demonstration. And so this concept of a chilling effect is fundamental to the idea of free speech, because although 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people signing a petition or demonstrating can have a powerful effect, each one of them individually knows that their signature or their participation will have individually essentially no effect. And so each of those 1,000 or 1,000,000 people can individually be deterred from exercising their right, with the consequence that the entire thinking process of the community is mutilated. And so that's really the crux of this question about government surveillance, is if the government can engage in that surveillance, it will have a chilling effect on the willingness of individuals to read those books, go to those lectures, sign those petitions that might be deemed suspect, that might result in a file being created on you. And that's the fear that a widespread use of government surveillance creates. And that's why Edward Leavy, as Attorney General, was right to have a sharp limitation on the ability of government to do that.
Jeffrey Stone is a University of Chicago law professor and author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, From the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. And I did my best to get as much of the second half of the book as we could into an hour. And I know we left a whole bunch of really important stuff out, but, you know, there's only so much time. I really appreciate you making yourself available to come back to talk about the rest of the book that we didn't get to in early April.
My pleasure. It's great talking to you.
All right. Well, thank you very much again. Take care.
You too.
Bye. Okay. So this is available at local bookstores, undoubtedly. If you want to find out a little bit more about it, I would suggest, let's see, it's published by Norton. You can also find out some information about it at Amazon.com, of course, but buy it locally. Don't buy it online. So I will be back next week, of course, with another program for you. If you have any questions or comments about this or other programs, you can email me at kboo@riseup.net. You can also send me regular postal mail here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. And I thank you very much for listening.